Hello, and welcome to the podcast where we're all sorry. Blood, sweat, and strife.
Yeah, we're very sorry for plaguing your ears with our shenanigans. You're probably going to hear some Ethan and Hambone at the end of the episode, and I'm sorry about that. But yeah, initially we did not conceptualize this as two separate episodes. We were just going to upload in like a two-hour-long chunk, but we decided that it would probably be in our best interest to split it up into two episodes. So this episode is going to be all about Madawan and Blair Mountain. There's a lot of twists and turns in this story, so buckle up.
Buckle up, I hardly knew her.
Yo. And now we're going to move on to the main event. Hey, this is Mason from the future, and I realized that I skipped over a really important note. So something that I should mention is there was this article written by John Neusinger, which covered the Madawan disaster. And one thing that he notes in his article is that over 90% of the land in Mingo and Logan counties was owned by outside interests. The powerful Mellon family owned mines in the area, but the dominant interest was a fiercely anti-union corporation, U.S. Steel, that owned over 32,000 acres in Mingo and Logan and another 50,000 acres in McDowell. British companies had also had extensive holdings. The fact was that Southern West Virginia was not owned and controlled by local capitalists, but by capitalists resident in New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, and London. The decision to wage murderous war on the Union was taken by these men. And I just think this quote is very illuminating because it shows us that in this context, like, even the land itself was owned by these private interests, which were fiercely anti-union. So, we have just covered the Payne and Cabin Creek uprisings, which happened from 1912 to 1913 in West Virginia. Now, we are going to cover something that happened in West Virginia from the period of 1920 to 1921. And these events are the Madawan Massacre and the Battle of Blair Mountain. So, at the time of 1920... there were 91,000 in West Virginia employed in and around the mines. 54,000 were in the UMWA, or the United Mine Workers of America, and 37,000 were unorganized. There were 4,000 unorganized miners in Mingo, and 9,000 unorganized miners in Logan County. This was out of a population of 1,485,000 people, so about 1/15 of the population was employed in and around the mines.
That's inside the entire state of West Virginia?
That's inside the entire state of West Virginia.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So, the fact that about half of the state was organized, or about half of the state that was part of the coal mining industry was organized, and half of the state was unorganized, was actually a huge issue for the miners. Or more specifically, the union. There is a quote from John Mitchell which says, "The strength of your union is not the best organized districts. Unfortunately, and I say it regretfully, it's the strength of its least organized districts, or its least organized fields. You cannot be permanently safe. You cannot rest in security until West Virginia, the Irwin Field, the Connellsville, and Myersdale regions of Pennsylvania are organized." The fact that there were these non-union fields, it created this competition in the labor market where companies would hire people who didn't belong to the union. In fact, they made them sign Yellow Dog contracts, which were contracts saying that they explicitly would not join a union. So there was this constant battle happening between the union and the coal companies. Unions wanted to get as many people in the fold as they possibly could so they could challenge power. And the coal operators wanted to keep their power. The UMWA, in fact, wanted the coal companies to be nationalized and regulated as a private good. So that's a little bit of the context. There was a boom in the coal industry in 1920, and firms were making a 100% of their profits back. So
wow.
They were making a lot of money. And wages reflected this. Wages were rising until 1919, when they were cut from $1,211 to $1,097. And this probably happened because of fluctuations in the market. you have these boom and these bust cycles, and during the bust, your wages get cut. So there were some improvements in the miners' lives during this period of time. Like, there was the abolition of child labor, there was more frequent paydays, and a rise in real wages, but there was also this paternalism in the company towns, which we've already talked about at length, so I'll only go over it briefly. Basically, everything came from the coal company. Votes were bought. Your house was owned by them, the company store was owned by them, you had to pay them rent, you had to pay them for medical services, they controlled the church, they controlled your school, they controlled every little element of your life. So eventually the miners struck. Senator Kenya of the committee was told by miners, and this was a later thing, but he was told by the miners that the reasons for the strike were the lack of check weighmen, the firing of workers for failing to trade at company stores, the inability to make a decent living, and the mine guard system, whereby the guards would evict a worker if he missed work because of illness. So not only are you getting yelled at for calling out off sick, you are losing your home. And then
what were check weighmen?
Check weighmen, they were the guys who would weigh the coal for...
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So they could, like, figure out how much coal had been hauled in and pay the workers accordingly.
Gotcha. So basically, they weren't even bothering to weigh the coal?
No, not really. They would just, like... They would just do it by the number of cars, basically.
I have some context on that in these hearing notes that we'll touch on later.
Okay. Oh, okay, cool.
Cool. So now we get to the Matawan Massacre. And there's a little bit of context for here. There's a couple of characters. And those characters, of course, are the Baldwin Felts guys because they had been hired by the mines operators. They just keep coming back. Baldwin Felts is all over this.
Yeah, I was going to say they are in everything.
They are in literally everything, like more so than the Pinkertons.
It's funny because Pinkerton's the more famous name of the two.
Yeah, it's really odd. But yeah, so there were a couple of players in this. One were the Baldwin Felts guys who were hired guns by the mine companies. There was Sid Hatfield, who was the sheriff of Matawan at the time, which was the town where the miners were going on strike. And he was born in, I believe, West Virginia. He served as a miner as a teenager, and he was a staunch supporter of the UMWA. There was also the mayor, Cabell Testerman, who himself had worked in the mines, and he was another staunch supporter of the UMWA. And these two groups, the Baldwin Felts guys and the UMWA supporters, would come to a head in the massacre at Matawan. So how it happened was the Baldwin Felts guys were forcibly going around evicting the miners from their homes. When Sid Hatfield, along with a group of deputized coal miners, confronted Albert Felts and his men over this, they presented him with a warrant for their arrest. But Felts responded with an Uno reverse card, and he said, "I'm not under arrest. You're actually under arrest."
Call an ambulance, but not for me.
But not for me.
So Felts responded with his own warrant for Hatfield's arrest. When they went back to Cabell Testerman, the mayor, with the warrants, he was the mayor of Logan County, he was shown the warrant for Hatfield's arrest, and he claimed it was a bogus warrant, which escalated to a shootout, leaving 10 dead or dying. Cabell Testerman was shot dead, and Sid Hatfield swiftly married his wife, which was a king move on his part. The context for that is Cabell Testerman actually had asked Sid Hatfield to remarry to his wife and take care of his kids in case anything happened to him. Then Cabell Testerman's life became Jesse Lee Maynard Testerman Hatfield.
They were a super early polyam, like Tropel. I'm absolutely convinced of this.
Same.
I'd like to say first, before we get into the events happening because Sid Hatfield was shot, he was the police chief in Matawan. I don't know if you said that.
Yeah, he was a police chief.
But he was a very friendly guy. The local people liked him a lot. Yes. When miners would get drunk after work, instead of locking them up in jail overnight, he would actually walk them back to their homes. And he was much more sympathetic to the union miners rather than the coal companies themselves. So people really liked him.
He was the extraordinarily rare situation of a quote-unquote good cop.
Right.
Yeah. And as what happens with any good cops, he was not allowed to live his life.
Yeah. Did I really forget to mention that he was a sheriff?
No, he was the police chief.
Oh, I think I just called him the sheriff.
How big was the department? Like, I mean, like what's the, like, in terms of context, it was a fairly small town, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I don't really know. I'd have to imagine it wasn't particularly big, because...
Was he elected? Maybe like five deputies.
Was he elected to that position, or...?
I think he was elected, yeah.
That would make sense. It would make sense then that the sheriff and the... or the chief of police and the... Because the mayor was also very sympathetic to the miners there, and it would make sense then that the elected officials were primarily elected by the miners, so...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, in this scrape, alongside of Cabell Testerman, two of the Phelps brothers died. Rest in piss. You will not be remembered fondly. Right. And then later on, like a year later, Sid Hatfield was implicated in dynamiting a coal tipple. The coal operators had actually framed him. And when he was about to go on trial for that, he was shot ascending the steps of the courthouse by a couple of Baldwin Phelps goons.
Yep.
Yep. So this enraged the miners, and this was the catalyst for the Battle of Blair Mountain. So should I just go right into it?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So now we come to the actual Battle of Blair Mountain, and once again, there are some characters that we need to introduce, specifically Don Chafin. So, Don Chafin was born the son of Sheriff Francis Marion Chafin. He attended business school and worked as a teacher for a little while. And then in 1908, Chafin was appointed the tax assessor in Logan County, and he was elected the sheriff of Logan County in 1912. So, once Don Chafin became the sheriff, the coal company started directly paying his salary. And Don Chafin, by conservative estimates, was receiving a salary of $32,700 a year, but some estimates put that as far as $61,000 a year. And then the company guards and the deputies were paid about $170 a month. So, Logan County was ruled by Don Chafin with an iron fist. Every train into Logan County was met by deputies for the purpose of rooting out union organizers, and if they found them to be union organizers, they would just beat the shit out of them. In some stories, there are some, like, wild stories about this guy. One such story is J.L. Heiser, who was chancellor of the Knights of Pythias, which was a secret fraternal organization founded by a member of the Supreme Court, was intimidated by Wayne Chafin, who stuck a pistol in Heiser's belly after concerns that he was there to organize people. When Heiser mentioned... When Heiser eventually met Don Chafin, Heiser was clubbed over the head by him, and then Heiser went back to his hotel, only for Chafin to relieve the front desk person of their duties and just shoot up the place. Nobody was hurt, but he did cause quite the fucking commotion.
Right, like just what we're talking about here is a law enforcement officer just setting up shop in a hotel lobby and just shooting, just randomly
just into the lobby. Just drunkenly firing his pistol.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... It bothers and I'm sure absolutely nothing happened to him for this.
Yeah, I actually don't have too much on what happened to Chafin after this, but that would be interesting to go into. We could probably tack something out at the very end where we talk about, like, what happened to Chafin afterwards.
What was his first name again?
Don. Yeah. He has, like, a cartoon villain name.
Hmm.
Yeah. But here's something directly from the Wikipedia. Chapin also established a record of violent and unpleasant confrontations with union officials outside of Logan County. In one such incident, September 1919, Chapin entered the office of the UMW in Charleston, West Virginia, while he was drunk, armed, and very belligerent. William Petrie, the vice president of the local union, asked Chapin to leave, but Chapin responded by brandishing a revolver. Petrie then shot Chapin in the chest with a .22 caliber pistol. Petrie was later cleared of criminal wrongdoing on the grounds that his action was self-defense, but he expressed no remorse about the shooting and later remarked, "That's what happens when a man carries a toy pistol. That goddamn son of a bitch is liable to get well. I should have had my old .44." In a second...
Based.
Yeah. Yeah. In the second shooting incident, a miner walked into Chafin's sheriff's office in Logan and, without a word, shot him in the chest. Chapin walked the 2 blocks to Logan General Hospital with a bullet lodged in his chest 2 inches from his heart. In a third incident, a disgruntled constituent walked into his office with a gun drawn and reportedly said, "Don Chapin, I'm going to shoot you dead." Chapin reached into his desk drawer and pulled out a pistol of his own and said, "Go ahead, we'll hop into hell together." The man left without firing a shot. So this guy led a pretty incredible life in the sense where, like, everybody with a decent head on their shoulders just hated him and wanted him dead.
What was the time scale for these shooting events?
I'm not sure.
Towards John. Okay. Because he would get worse, too. He would commit some more atrocities, as we'll talk about later, during the actual battle.
Yeah. Okay. So, now we get into what the actual battle was like. So, 10,000 miners set off from Marmot to march on Mingo County to unionize them and liberate them from martial law. Martial law had been declared because of the scrapes between the union and the union officials, or the scrapes between the union and the coal operators. And the miners wanted to lift martial law because martial law is a very bad thing. It means that you can just be shot and nobody will ever see any consequences for that. They tied red bandanas around their guns and their necks, and they called themselves the Redneck Army. These bandanas were handed out to them by the UMWA, which was also giving them, like, weapons and ammunition and all that other stuff. So they were armed when they marched, and they eventually came across Chafin's 2,000-strong army of recently deputized men, which was made up of the police force, as well as local militiamen, businessmen, and professional people, as well as members from the Baldwin Phelps gangs. And Chafin and his men set up machine gun nests in Blair Mountain to stop the miners. At one point, the miners actually broke through their defensive lines and fought on Blair Mountain for the entire day. 5 private biplanes equipped with tear gas and pipe bombs were used against the miners, and a lot of people died.
I'd like to, sorry to interrupt you here, I'd like to add some context to the martial law that comes up in the hearing notes. And I don't know how you want to edit this together, Isabel, if you want to pop me in between that. I just didn't want to interrupt your flow at the moment. But the declaration of martial law in Mingo County was considered to be illegal by the courts because the state had no formal military force. And since martial law is the command of the military being given, there was no military to give command, and it was actually the state police who were in charge.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was directly by the state courts declared to be illegal. And the governor did it twice. He tried to enact martial law twice, and the second time made a, what's a good term for this? I guess makeshift. It's not what I was thinking, but it works. A makeshift military, which included coal operators, ex-Baldwin Phelps detectives, men that participated with the coal operators during the Cabin and Paint Creek strikes. Several of those men were under indictment. There were men under bond for other crimes, men on parole from different penitentiaries, and ex-convicts. So these are, you know, these are the kind of people that they set up their martial law under.
Just literally just a fascist militia.
Right. Yeah. They basically just built themselves their own like private military.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's incredible when you read about these things because like they seem like they shouldn't be able to happen. And on paper they shouldn't because there's laws in place preventing this sort of thing. But it just kind of goes to show that you don't have to follow the law when you have enough money.
Right. And this is 1920s, you know, 1910s, 1920s, United States of America, quote unquote, home of the free, and or land of the free, home of the brave, or whatever the hell it is. But it just that should really give you pause. You know what I mean? Like, this is the sort of stuff our country has done and continues to do to retain its supremacy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
These are not isolated incidents.
I have a direct quote from Fred Mooney, who is the Secretary Treasurer of District 17 of the United Mine Workers. But he said, "We took habeas corpus proceedings, or had our lawyer do so, to secure the release of these men." The men being men that were arrested during the first instance of martial law, striking miners. He goes on to say they were released, and the Supreme Court, in its decision, said that the proclamation of martial law was illegal because of the fact that a proclamation of martial law was incident to occupation and the state having no military force, that the proclamation of martial law was illegal. Since that time, the governor has reissued another proclamation of martial law. And then he goes on to describe the sorts of people that they made up their military force of.
Good.
Yeah. It's, once again, it's really incredible reading about all this stuff. And it's very eye-opening. Like, knowing that this sort of thing can happen, it makes you want to, figure out how you can prevent it, I think. Or at least that's what it does for me. So yeah, thank you for giving more context. Very well put, and that quote was great.
I'm sorry for interrupting your flow, but you can go ahead and take it away again.
Oh, that's okay. I was just wrapping up. So yeah, eventually the miners broke through defensive lines and fought on Blair Mountain. There were 5 private biplanes equipped with tear gas and 27 pipe bombs. Or I misread. There were 5 private biplanes equipped with tear gas and pipe bombs were used against miners. And
by Chafin,
right. So yeah, this is striking miners.
Yes, and literally air striking them.
They are attacking people on strike and their families with aircraft and chemical weapons.
This is also with the help of normal townsfolk that they deputized after they brainwashed them against the strikers.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Like, let that sink in. Like, this is, like, again, just to reiterate from what we said before, this is what anarcho-capitalism looks like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was actually an attempt to stop all of this from happening. There was a brief attempt at a ceasefire, but that hope was dashed after Chafin's men shot Union sympathizers. So what we have here is Chafin instigating a battle. Not operating defensively, not protecting people and maintaining law and order, but actually instigating a battle which should be illegal to participate in.
Right.
Yeah. So after days of fighting, eventually 27,000 American troops were called in and the miners gave up. A lot of the miners themselves had served in World War I and they didn't want to fire on American troops because they probably saw themselves in those people, and at that point they were just outnumbered. Like, the federal government was being called in. At that point they just decided to pack it up and go home. 985 miners were indicted for treason and murder. Some were acquitted while others served years in prison. And I think that's where my part of the podcast wraps up for the moment.
I'd like to add in that this posse that Chafin had amassed was the nation's largest private armed force ever seen to that point.
Jeez.
Wow.
He literally built a private army.
Insane.
I know. Well, I can actually add a little bit more to that.
Thank you.
The Blair Mountain battle itself was relatively non-lethal because of the terrain in which it was fought. It was heavily forested, so a lot of the shots either were not lined up properly because of line of sight, or they hit trees because of all the tree cover. Unfortunately, the miners never made it through the mountain because, as Mason said, the federal troops came in. The miners, many of which were veterans, so they, once the federal troops came in, they lost interest because they didn't want to fight against, you know, the state and the military that they had partnered with previously. They said that specifically they were only interested in waging war on the coal operators and not the country itself. And the death toll was estimated at 16. Obviously, it's hard to tell completely because it was such a wide area and it was, a forested mountain, which people go missing on those to this day, so there's no way to know if they found all the bodies. But even if the death count was only 16, a lot of the miners were evicted from their homes in company towns or jailed by violent means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's I think, one of the grimmer chapters out of our nation's history. General, was the coal wars as a whole.
Right. The labor leaders were actually charged with insurrection, but the West Virginian juries would often side with the miners rather than the coal companies, so most of them were found not guilty.
That's good.
I did look up a little bit on what happened with Don Chafin after all of this. He would go back to being the sheriff for a while until eventually getting busted for violation of the Volstead Act.
What's the Volstead Act?
Otherwise known as Prohibition.
So he was running liquor.
He was a booze hound.
Yeah, and so he did some jail time for that. But then he got out, and because he still had a lot of contacts in the Democratic Party, he was able to reestablish himself in Charleston and lived a long and relatively happy, wealthy life, because of course he did.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, something that should be mentioned is this was an anti-racist coalition that marched on Mingo County. I
wouldn't say specifically anti-racist, but they understood that they had the same class interests and that they were on the same side.
You're probably correct. But yeah, like, this was a coalition of people who recognized that their class interests aligned with the miners, regardless of the color of their skin. And the company would often bring in black scabs and, like, Eastern European scabs and Italian scabs to, because, one, they couldn't speak English, or some of them couldn't speak English, so without a common tongue, they were less likely to organize. And, two, because this fostered a lot of racial resentment from the white miners towards the black miners who would come in and do their jobs for them. However, the UMWA was a desegregated union, and they actually had black organizers among them. One was a man named Fewclose Johnson, who was part of the Dirty 11, which was a commando outfit that fought in the Battle of Blair Mountain. And there are stories of the miners holding cafeteria workers at gunpoint and not letting up until everybody was fed. So, like, if a cafeteria didn't want to feed a black person, then that was just too bad, and they would have a gun pointed at them.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep, pretty cool.
Fucking based.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have some notes here on a hearing before the Committee on Education and Labor. This was basically, to put it simply, a hearing of two opposing sides. We have the UMWA on one side, and we have the coal operators on the other, and the coal operators were pushing to get the miners to be forced to go back to work, and the UMWA was pushing for more workers' rights and fairer conditions. I'll begin here with the opening statement of Neil Birkinshaw, who was on the side of the UMWA. He would, in his opening statement, claim that the U.S. Coal Commission increased wages by 24% to 27% nationwide, but that it did not apply to miners in the Mingo coal field, which is, as you know, where the strikers came from. The miners were unable to keep up with their rising costs of living and requested salary increases. The mine operators would go on to ignore these. Again, we're seeing the same thing that we talked about last time, right, where they're not even saying no, they're just literally ignoring them.
Yeah.
It's the exact same pattern every single time for decades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The miners ask for something so they can survive, the mine operators say no, the miners go on strike, and then there's a big battle.
Yep. But after this, this is when they would put their formal request in to join the UMW. Frank Keeney, who was a representative of the UMW, apparently refused to allow them to join until they got their mine operational again. They did this, and then Keeney would allow them to unionize. They started the process by setting up shop in a church in the local town. They posted flyers for the union, and that same day, the church was filled up to 3 times its capacity with people interested in joining.
Wow.
So there was a big demand for this. People really wanted their rights, apparently.
Yeah.
So I have a quote here directly from Neil Birkinshaw that says, "As those men joined the United Mine Workers, they were out of a job for taking advantage of their rights as citizens to join any organization they saw fit. They were fired, and not only fired, but they were evicted from their homes. These people were driven like cattle from their homes, and their goods were thrown out into the roads, and some lived in tents and railroad stations and temporary shelters, and others even were without shelter until the United Mine Workers Organization at Charleston sent them tents. And to this day, those people are living in tents. They lived there during the winter. I was down there last November and saw barefoot children, women with a single garment, and men barefooted with nothing but overalls living in that cold. It is a high mountain country, and it is very cold. They suffered tortures that I have never seen before in this or any other countries."
Wow.
Yeah.
So the mine operators were totally willing to just let these people freeze to death if it meant not giving them, or not giving into their demands.
I think it's important to note that the conditions that we're discussing here are conditions that still exist in the world today. Like, just look at our exploding homeless population in America. And no, the homeless people are not exploding. Their population is.
Much to the chagrin of liberals everywhere.
Much to the chagrin of liberals. Right? But yeah, like, these conditions are still present in America. It's just that we don't really get to see them that much because there's so little media coverage of these events. Much in the same way that the Cold Wars have been wiped from the history books and American curricula across the country. So too are normal, everyday people who just had a bad stroke of luck and ended up out on the street.
Doesn't matter, because there's no profit to be made from housing them or feeding them.
Yeah.
No, there's not. And that's really what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, continuing on here quickly, this is an even more ludicrous example of the mine operators ignoring the miners' demands. On July 1st of 1920, the miners would hold a convention to formulate the demands that they would serve to the coal operators. About 4,000 men attended this conference, and the operators refused to even allow them to present their demands.
Wow.
So they didn't ignore them, they didn't say no, they just completely outright refused to listen.
Mm-hmm.
May 18th of the same year, this was when martial law was enacted, which we spoke about before. Major Thomas Davis was put in charge. This is when the West Virginia Supreme Court would state that the martial law was illegal and unenforceable. It was being run by the state police at first before they made their sham militia. The operators would try to discredit the union miners by claiming that they were foreign-born Bolsheviks, but in reality, the majority of the miners were born in the United States, and most of the immigrants were Italian. So, not from Russia.
No. No.
I wanted to point out that it's a little weird that in this, you know, in the language of this hearing, they refer to the workers as stock, like pure American stock or foreign-born stock. It's very weird, very dehumanizing.
Well, it's part and parcel of the commodification of everything
under capitalism. Yes, including labor.
Yes. They try not to be so mask off with it anymore, but that even that's like slowing down. And we see that. I mean, with what the COVID they call pandemic.
When workers leave the country, they call it like, what is it, labor capital flight or whatever?
Right.
Human
capital flight, that's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And the awful the sad thing is that a lot of parts like a big part of the reason why the Appalachians are so, like, that region of the country is so poor now is the capitalist class never forgot any of this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
No.
There's
but a they reason. Sure as shit paid to make sure that the working class would forget about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. The people that live in that area pay the price for standing up to the coal barons of yesteryear to this day.
Exactly.
And even in modern coal mines, obviously conditions aren't the exact same as they were before, but we do see a continuing deterioration of a lot of the protections that the miners did fight for.
Yeah.
Cases of black lung are back on the rise again amongst coal miners. And they have an even harder time now getting any kind of support for their strikes because they work in an industry that is destroying the planet.
Yeah.
All right, not to mention healthcare has become so much more inaccessible now compared to how it was back then.
Yeah.
Right.
Because this was back, I think this was before healthcare was privatized fully in the United States.
Also, the unions just aren't as strong as they used to be, nor are they as revolutionary as they used to be. No,
they aren't.
Like, after World War One, like, during World War One, there was a lot of, like, the government essentially worked with unions because they wanted that good output, that good, like, happy laborers could give them. Right. And then after that, corporations and government pursued what was known as the American Plan or no union strategy. And I actually read this one article that pointed out this pattern of coal operators essentially provoking a strike, ending them by force, and then blacklisting all the strikers. And this would cause the unions to just hemorrhage membership.
Yep. We see that pattern play out quite a bit over the labor's history in the United States here. And
yeah.
Between that and then we had what Reagan did in the 1980s.
Yeah.
That really hamstrung labor movements, especially when they came to the Air Traffic Controllers Union.
Yeah.
What he did there set a precedent, not just for air traffic controllers, but for all unions. And to this day, it's still illegal for air traffic controllers to go on strike.
Yeah.
You know, the
union that wasn't gutted is the police union, and police are the direct defenders of the state.
Right.
So it makes sense that they wouldn't gut their own protection.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, the police union is effectively just another arm of the state.
Yeah. Another thing, too, is a lot of industry started moving south, which was less friendly to unions. And this is actually one of the more, like, theoretical talking points that I'm going to touch on. But in the South, you didn't really have as much industry. It wasn't as industrialized. You had a lot of what was basically a neo-slave class. You had a lot of sharecroppers. And in the North, you had a lot of factories. So there was a more advanced industrial, like, union movement going on there. But, like, after the 1920s, or, like, during the 1920s, a lot of industry started moving down south, where the labor laws were more lax, because there wasn't as much pressure being put on the state to enact those labor laws. And it's essentially the same process as, like, outsourcing to another country, like we see today. It's the same thing as GM moving their manufacturing plants over to Taiwan or fucking wherever, because they are going, that is what is going to make them the most money at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's that labor theory of value again.
Right.
Yeah.
Where they can, they will always move to where they can exploit the most labor.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know. And that's a factor in and of itself. One of the reasons the United States has military bases all over the globe is that we have corporate interests all over the globe. Then U.S. companies found it easier to just start exporting a lot of the more troublesome labor and more expensive labor to other parts of the world where they could more easily control the population.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I think this actually dovetails very nicely into West Virginia's current governor, Jim Justice.
Wait, yeah. I'm not even done with my hearing notes here.
Oh, your hearing notes. We still gotta go through those. Sorry.
We do. That's all right. That's pretty much all of Neil Birkinshaw done. And I have a short section here on the opening statement of the representative for the other side, the coal operators, Colonel Z.T. Vinson. I don't like this guy. He plays a lot of the same games that you'll see, you know, the bourgeois or the ruling class now play in their wording of things, which we'll touch on more in his questioning of people in a little bit. And this won't take too long, but Vinson claims that for the past 20 years, there have been no issues between the operators, the employers, and the employees. And as we've covered in however many hours we've been talking about this subject, that is verifiably false.
Yeah.
The reason they're having this whole hearing at this committee is because of the issues that they've been having.
Yeah.
So this guy's very first claim is bullshit.
What was his name again?
Z.T. Vinson.
Z.T. Vinson is putting his fingers in his ears and going, la la la, I'm not listening to you. Yes.
He
is.
he was turned around facing the other way during all the strife, and then the committee starts, and he turns around, and he's like, well, I didn't see anything. Okay, so one of the other claims that Vinson would make was that the wages earned by the non-unionized miners were as high or possibly the highest paid to any miners in the U.S.
Yeah.
A verifiably false claim.
He was claiming that, like, people could be making, like, $500 a month when the company guards weren't even paid that much money. And in my reading of this, I found that it actually is kind of hard to tell just how much the discrepancy in pay was between the union and the non-union fields, because they use different metrics for payment. However, we do know that union fields set the upwards trend, and non-union fields set the lower trend.
Mm.
Right, yeah. And I don't want to be accused of being biased here when I say that he claims things, and sometimes I won't say that the other side claims things. But the thing is, a lot of these union officials provided sources to this committee.
Yeah.
And that's something that Vinson wasn't always able to do, because there weren't always sources for his claims.
Also, like, we need to keep in mind, too, that these testimonies of these coal miners, like, what reason do they have to lie? It's not like they were exaggerating their conditions. They are the victims here.
Right. And I'm not even talking about just the testimonies. I mean the things claimed in the opening statement Birkinshaw had sources for. So does Mooney.
Yeah.
They have documents that they brought with them to the court. And this a little funny thing we'll touch on in a little bit regarding that. But that's for a little bit later here.
Mm-hmm.
Vinson said that the United Mine Workers were claiming to be entitled to the full social value of their labor, which includes all of the money made by the mines aside from transportation fees, which is based. But they do not propose to pay the present owners one solitary cent, which is also based, as well as not paying for the facilities themselves. He claims this makes them robbers and says that because of the UMW goals of this manner, it isn't slander to say so. So basically, they just wanted to claim the means of production.
Yep.
Yep.
He would go on to claim that UMW members were assassinating mine guards and scabs, and that Major Tom Davis arrested a multitude of people, most of whom were from out of state. So he was saying that this was a conspiracy from outside of the state of West Virginia. He fully admits to not hiring unionized workers and firing people who were attempting to organize, which was completely unconstitutional. He also, before he claimed, or before he admitted to this, he claimed it wasn't true, and he tried to sort of dance around it. And the senator, one of the senators pushed him to finally admit that they don't hire union workers.
Wow.
It's my opinion, to claim that, Birkinshaw's statement was a thorough retelling of the mistreatment of the miners and their families. He provided evidence, whereas this opening statement by Vinson, was just about playing the victim and outright asking for the protection of the committee, which he did multiple times and would continue to do throughout the hearing. Now we'll go on to a statement made by Fred Mooney, who I mentioned before, is the Secretary-Treasurer of District 17. He had to open his statement by saying that he's not a foreign agitator, and that he was born in Loudoun District in the Kanawha County of West Virginia. He said that he started working in the mines at the age of 16, and at the time of this hearing was 33. He goes on to say that the situation in Mingo County that was going on during this hearing began sometime around May of 1920, but that back in 1919, there were requests and committees to unionize which were refused to be seen by the coal operators. He would go on to talk about 400 men striking, sending a committee directly to the UMWA's office in Charleston. This is what I mentioned before, where they were refused unless they went and got their mine back into operation, which they did. The first groups to organize were ordered to vacate company premises due to being union-affiliated, so the coal operators literally kicked them out of their homes once they unionized.
Wow.
So the UMWA had to supply them tents and property to place them on. So they paid for the tents and the property they would come to live on.
Wow.
Yeah, that's part of why they spent so much money on this whole situation.
Yeah.
Some of the operators did not evict the newly unionized workers from their property, however, which I guess you could say was kind of good on their part, but a lot of them did. Many of these workers had their furniture thrown out onto public highways, and before they could get their tents delivered, their furniture was ruined by the weather. Mooney claims that the West Virginia law says that there will be no discriminatory retaliation against union members, as well as the prohibition of armed guards or detectives being employed in industrial controversies. And he would provide the word of law to the committee. He had a document with the law printed out on it. The only counties in West Virginia without union labor, regarding specifically coal, were Logan, Mingo, McDowell, Wyoming, Mercer, and some parts of Raleigh. The whole rest of West Virginia was unionized. After a few interjections by Neil Birkinshaw about the miners' wages in regards to the union versus non-union miners, Mr. Mooney goes on to discuss the guns and gunmen that were accused of being brought into the state. I have a quote from him here that says, "We will introduce witnesses to prove that immense quantities of high-power rifles and ammunition and guns have been brought into that territory by the operators." And he would also say, "The same gunman that came into the town of Mattawan to conduct the evictions in 1920 which brought about the controversy on May 19th of 1920, are the same men that participated in the Cabin and Paint Creek Strike of 1912 and 13. They're the same men that participated in the Colorado Strike of 1913. So he has evidence with him to corroborate this accusation that these same people have been committing the same atrocities for almost a decade.
Right. And we all know in retrospect that they were 100% correct, too.
Yeah.
Hindsight's always 20/20, and we have 100 years of hindsight here.
Exactly.
So, I have one testimony that I'm going to go through here, because this document is incredibly long. It's over 1,000 pages. It takes place in two parts. We're going to have all of our sources linked, including this one, once all this goes up. I highly recommend looking into it. It's a very fascinating read. A lot of the time I would forget to take notes because I would just sit there and read it as if it was a play. It's really that interesting.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
I imagine if you're someone that's listened to this all the way through, you would be interested in reading some of this document. And the Google upload of it has the table of contents is all hyperlinked. So you can click on whatever testimony you want to read. It'll take you right there. It's very convenient. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to move on here to the testimony of Frank Ingham. Frank Ingham had been a miner in Mingo County for 14 years, but after joining the union, he was discharged and served a notice by the constable, William Blair, to vacate the company property within 5 days. However, the date posted on the notice was 2 days prior to him actually receiving it, so he really only had 3 days to gather all of his belongings, his family, and move. He would move to McVeigh, Kentucky, to work for Pond Creek Coal Company for about 2 weeks before the manager there, Mr. Hogan, came down into the mine at 3 o'clock, saying that he received a phone call from the previous mine saying that Frank was part of the union and that the Pond Creek Coal Company should fire him, which they did.
Wow.
Frank would then, he was blacklisted. Frank would then go to, or here's a quote from him. He said, came to Alfax under the electric collieries, which are coal facilities. And he worked there 5 days before that manager, Mr. Leckie, came with the exact same message, and he was also fired. Mm-hmm. A quote here from him says, I came back to West Virginia and went to L.G. Brady, and I said, I have been blacklisted by the operators after serving about 30 years in the mines, and I would like to get some work to do to make an honest living. I want some kind of work if you will give it to me. So this man was literally begging for work. He was given new work at a coal drift and allegedly paid very well. However, his wife, who was teaching school at the prior mine he'd been discharged from, warned him not to come back to their home because things would not be good for him. Apparently, this was a threat, not by his wife, of course, but by the people in the area who would be hostile to him if he would return to the area. Frank asked the superintendent of the Lee District Board of Education to transfer his wife to a new school, but they turned him down. So he ended up having to get a room for his wife to stay at because he couldn't come pick her up from the school. One of the operators that blacklisted Frank, H.D. Ingram, sent for Frank, asking him to come back and finish up a job, then go back to loading coal for him again. This was in August of 1920. Quote, he sent word that if I would renounce my unionism, I could come back. But no man would ever poke his head into a drift if he claimed to have a drop of union blood in him. End quote.
Wow.
The he in this case being H.D. Ingram. So, I mean, coal drifts were they were more dangerous than, you know, an underground mine.
So they were basically calling union men a bunch of cowards, right?
No, this was Frank saying that.
Oh, this is Frank.
Union men would refuse to work in drifts because they were dangerous.
Yeah. Which is smart, yeah. Like,
yeah, I mean, they were looking out for their own best interests.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not worth the whatever $3 a day you were paid if you would just die.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
After a warning he received from the paymaster at Ingram's establishment, warning Frank to be careful when visiting his sister, visiting Frank's sister, Frank wasn't having an affair with the paymaster's sister, he decided to go anyway. So Frank went to visit his sister. And upon returning back to Williamson, he was arrested by a prohibition officer by the last name of Collins. We don't get his first name in this part of the document. He searched Frank openly at the train station in front of the public, so there were many observers there, and then they carried him through the station and locked him into a jail cell. I have another quote here from Frank that says, and on the way from the station to the jail, he says, what we ought to do with him. He cursed me and called me abusive names. He says, what we ought to do with him is not to take him to jail, but to riddle his body with bullets on the street. I says, gentlemen, what have you got me for? He says, shut up. Don't open your mouth. I will blow your brains out.
Holy shit.
Jeez.
Yeah. So that is allegedly a direct quote from the prohibition officer and his deputies.
Mm-hmm.
Frank would say that the officers included were Collins, Mr. Carter, and Ed. Frank was placed in Welch Jail, McDowell County. He asked to speak to his lawyer, Joe Crockett, to have him investigate what was happening. The sheriff allegedly shook his finger in Frank's face and said, I'm not going to let you out of this jail. Frank then asked to send a message to his wife to let her know the situation, to which the sheriff would reply, the only message you can get out will be to God, and unless you hurry, you will fail in that.
Jeez.
Yeah, this guy was a real hard ass.
Yeah.
Frank shouted to the other inmates that he thought he was going to be killed. Some of the others said that he wouldn't be killed, and that this was an intimidation tactic that the police would use towards union members. The sheriff and his ilk began to take Frank out of his jail cell at a little bit past midnight. Frank recalls this because he could see the clock tower on the courthouse across the way from his cell. I have another quote here from him. It says, I got up and went out with him, and there was 7 men there in the office. They had 2 automobiles standing in front of the office out front, and they says, get up into that car. The sheriff says, I want to carry you down the road. There's some men down there that want to talk to you. I said, gentlemen, this is a very unusual thing, to take me out of jail and have me make a statement to men down the road. If they want me to make a statement, I prefer to make it here. And when I said that, one of them struck me on the head with an iron club. Yeah. So, this man has just consistently faced, you know, police brutality over the course of this day.
Why don't we have a labor movement in this country? Because it's been brutally suppressed.
Yeah. I'd like to point out that in the hearing document, Frank's a black man, and he has colored written in parentheses next to his name in the document, which I thought was racist, but in an interesting way.
Yeah. Hmm.
They differentiated between the testimonies of white and colored men.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I don't know if maybe the fact that he was black exacerbated the police brutality or not. It didn't seem like he thought so. He thought it was just because he was a union man.
Yeah.
But one of the senators of the committee, Senator Shortridge, asks who struck Frank on the head, to which Frank responds, Mr. Kreider, a prohibition officer in McDowell County, of which he does not know the first name. Another quote from Frank here. Then he pulled out a pair of suspenders out of his left pocket, and he took those suspenders and he put them around my wrist and he threw me into the car. So they arrested him, you know, without any cause, because Shortridge would further ask for elaboration if Frank had been charged with anything. Frank would say, no, sir, I've been in West Virginia for 30 years, and I've never had any... And at this point, he's interrupted by the chairman of the committee, who interrupts with, and I quote, it seems to me they enforce the prohibition law pretty strenuously down there, end quote. This obviously had nothing to do with the prohibition. This guy was just a fucking dickhead.
Yeah.
Right.
Just because there were prohibition officers arresting him doesn't mean it was related to the prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
Shortridge would tell Frank to proceed, and he proceeds with this quote. Then they drove the car down there between Welch and Hemphill, and there they stopped and they dragged me out of the car, and they took me about 100 yards away from the car, and they began to beat me over the head and back with these iron clubs. And when they decided that I was dead, when they decided there was not any life in me, they drew off of me and stood and talked. And Ed Johnson, the sheriff's deputy, he came back to me and kicked me in the face, end quote.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was all in the span of a day as well.
Oh my god.
Or an afternoon, because, you know, he got back to the train station in the afternoon, they pulled him out, and this all happened a little after midnight.
Yeah.
Edward Johnson, who Frank had prior referred to as Ed, took Frank's belongings out of his pocket. $25.07, a receipt from R.H. Campbell, from whom he had borrowed $100, and a receipt from one Dr. Hamburger, as well as a railroad ticket. Once their cars were out of earshot, Frank got up and found his way to a small coaling station. The workers there asked Frank what happened, and he said he met the hands of the mob for being a union member. He said that he recognized the men who beat him as men who worked for the coal operators. A story of how he recognized them, he tells of how at the Howard Mine in Chatteroy, they were loading cars for 66 cents. After a cost of living increase, the miners would ask for 10 cents more per car. And after this, there was a meeting called. It was agreed upon that they would receive 9 cents more, and the miners were satisfied. Until later in that evening, after they came out of the mines, there was a notice on the company's office saying that every necessary product for the miners was increasing in price from 5 cents to 25 cents, and it was now compulsory for the miners to only shop at the company store. Yeah. So they gave them a slight raise and then forced them to buy their overpriced products.
Yep. Sounds like capitalism.
Yeah. As the miners showed their dissatisfaction, three of the same men that would batter Frank later on were brought in, because this was a flashback. I say flashback, and I guess this isn't like a Marvel movie, but it kind of reads like one sometimes. The men that would later batter Frank were brought in by the coal operators after the men showed their dissatisfaction at the scam they were pulling, and started threatening and beating the miners with their pistols. They threatened to shoot a miner, who Frank referred to as Melon, for wanting to go back in and fetch his clothes out of the mine. And back to Frank's present story before this tangent was, he was fired by Ingram, again, for advising the other black men there not to take the place of the white union workers who were fired for being union. His claim was that he didn't want them to spark a race war. So he didn't want, you know, the black men to become scabs and cause, you know, racial distress. Frank estimated that over 2 to 5 years of work, his daily wage was about $4.50, which is vastly less than what Colonel Vinson was claiming that miners in this area would make.
Yeah.
Yeah, Frank would say there were no fixed hours, but the foreman would typically make them work 10. So even though there were no, like, documented fixed amounts of hours they had to work, the foremans would keep them in the mines until they worked an adequate quote-unquote amount. Not only were they not paying out for the cars loaded by weight, like Mason mentioned earlier, they were forcing them to be overfilled. The drivers of the cars would rest their elbows on the edges of them and put their hands skyward, and they would tell the miners to keep filling up until the coal could be seen coming up over their fingers. So these cars were decided to hold a level amount of coal, and they were being forced to overfill them, which was not only unsafe, but it was extra work they weren't being paid for.
Yeah.
The warrant for Frank's arrest, after the fact, claimed that he had walked through the tent colony and a mass of people followed him into the woods, and they charged him with conspiracy. They thought he was building a militia, but this was not verified.
It's really weak reasoning to arrest somebody.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is.
You went into the woods with a bunch of people. You're under arrest.
Yeah, exactly. Frank would later on work for the UMW after he was completely shut out of working for any mines in the area. He did, you know, odd jobs around the tent colonies, like delivering coal, helping people set up their tents, bringing food deliveries, tent deliveries, you know, all kinds of odd jobs that he could do. And he was paid $4 a day, I believe, for that. But Mr. Avis, the prosecutor for the opposing side, the coal operators, cross-examined Frank, and he asked him all kinds of, you know, leading questions about where he was specifically, like, the kinds of things that people aren't going to remember because it's things you're not really thinking about at the time. He asked him how the wages were at the mines. He asked him how much the UMW were paying him. And then he accuses Frank of being paid by the UMW for not working at all. He's basically calling him lazy, saying that he just didn't want to work in the mines because the UMW pays for him to do nothing. He basically accused him of sitting around all day.
Yeah.
But That's the end of my notes that I have here on this specific hearing. But like I said before, I highly recommend that anybody interested look into it. It's fascinating. Yeah. And there are hundreds of testimonies.
I read a little bit of it myself. And yeah, it is a very fascinating document. It's what happens when everybody is forced to answer for what they had been doing. And the coal operators just come out looking like garbage.
Yeah.
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 So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a microcosm of American imperialism in general. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it is, like what yeah. we were talking about earlier, where these are the kind of tactics that they still use to this day with the U.S. military or private military corporations around the world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, the first bombs dropped on American soil, like the first airstrikes on American soil, were from Americans.
Yeah. Yeah, bombing striking workers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Tulsa, just bombing black people that dared to be moderately successful, mm-hmm. even under all of the horrible conditions that the United States puts them under. So,
mm-hmm. I mean, how many blocks burned down?
I can't remember now. We're talking about the bombing of what's I think it usually is referred to as the bombing of Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, yeah. Which was in the 1910s. I think. I can't remember exactly when, but yeah.
Yeah, that was the topic for another day.
Right. But those are the earliest uses that we see of aircraft to drop bombs in the United States. They weren't, you know, Japan attacking us at Pearl Harbor or anything like that. It was the United States dropping bombs on its own people.
Yeah.
And we say the United States because these were officials that were acting in official capacities at the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've covered who was involved. We had the National Guard. We had state militias. We had federal troops involved in some cases. Elected sheriffs.
Yeah. So now that we've wrapped up Jeremy's notes, I would like to take us into the current day a little bit. And take a look at West Virginia's governor, Jim Justice, one of my favorite guys. Forbes estimate...
the coolest guy.
The coolest guy. Yeah. Forbes estimates that this guy's net worth is $1.6 billion. He is the current governor of West Virginia. And he got his money by being the CEO of over 50 companies, including hotels and coal mines.
Bum, 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 bum.
Yep, he owns coal mines all up and down the East Coast, and he is the most powerful man in West Virginia. So I looked into it a bit, and his coal mines actually have, like, twice the national average of accidents and, like...
Wow.
Like, bad safety conditions. He owes fines to the government for occupational safety hazards. And yeah, accidents in his mines exceed the national average by nearly 100%. It's insane. He also owes a bunch of money in back taxes, and he, over the course of a bunch of years, he has paid more than $128 million in judgments and settlements over his business's unpaid bills. And he also passed the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, which makes it a felony for protesting oil or natural gas facilities. So the same tactics that were used back then are still there. We see the merging of private and public interests. We see mistreatment of workers. And we see the criminalization of things like protesting oil and natural gas facilities. So, in a way, like, we've come a long way since the early 1900s, but I don't think we've actually come that far because the same power structures are still essentially in place.
Right. Oh, and also interesting, I didn't get a chance to read the news article about it, but I just saw something come across my Twitter feed saying that the Supreme Court may be poised to give a ruling that will grant businesses the power to sue striking workers.
Woo! You love it.
Yep.
Oh, God.
I mean, I don't think it's a surprise that we're seeing that kind of legislation coming down. They're not legislation, but we're seeing something like that in motion. And I also honestly think we begin to see, with stuff like this, the true purpose of the Supreme Court, which is to allow really unpopular and unpleasant things that nobody wants, other than the ruling class, to become the law of the land.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I had another further thought with it and I forgot now. Anyway.
That's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the media did a good job of villainizing this whole situation. I mean, to this day, when you think of Appalachian people, you think of them as backwards mountain people.
Right.
Yeah. That was by design.
Yep.
They portrayed them as being violent, as being stupid. And this is still the stereotype that haunts them to this day.
I'll never forgive them for Eefing and Hambone, but they deserved better.
You start out with the letter E.
Mm-hmm.
You say E.
Mm-hmm.
I say E, and then you go... and then you kind of gasp. And you put the three together, E, like that. And then you do I.
All right, so as always, our sources are going to be posted. We thank you all for listening. If you did listen this far, you're beautiful, you're intelligent, we love you.
Yeah, each and every one of you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Yes, each and every, if you know, you each deserve a consensual forehead kiss and a head pat.
Exactly. If you listen to me say every fifth word for the past like hour, then like I don't know
shot.
What to say.
Don't take a shot for each one.
Don't take a shot for each one. You will die of alcohol poisoning.
You know what? No, you know what I'm gonna do now is I'm gonna go through and edit all of the ums out, but I'm going to leave this bit in at the end.
You have to leave that part in too, where you say that, so that they just find out. But yeah, I'd like to wrap up here with a quote by Cecil E. Roberts, who is the current president of the UMWA as of this recording. He said, "Blair Mountain stands as a pivotal event in American history, where working men and women stood up to the lawless coal barons of the early 20th century and their private armies and fought for their rights as Americans, and indeed, the rights of working families all over the world. It is a place where we can all be reminded that workers in this nation were literally forced to fight for their rights, and that those rights must constantly be defended or they will be lost. Blair Mountain is a beacon for all those who support American ideals of democracy, fairness, and freedom, which is what the miners were fighting for."
Hmm. Very nice.
Very nice. I like that. All right. Well, that, thank you so much, everyone. You do.
Yeah. I've been Mason.
I remain you still Isabel. Are too.
I've been Jeremy, and we'll see how I feel tomorrow.
Yeah.